This is Macro Voices with hedge fund manager Eric Townsend, the free weekly financial podcast targeting professional finance, high net worth individuals, family offices, and other sophisticated investors. Macro Voices is all about the brightest minds in the world of finance and macroeconomics telling it like it is, bullish or bearish, no holds barred. Now, here are your hosts, Eric Townsend and Patrick Serezna.
Macro Voices episode 74 was recorded on August 3rd, 2017. I'm Eric Townsend. We've got a fantastic show for you this week, folks. Julian Brigden and Raoul Paul have both reached a point in their careers where their investment insights are so well respected by institutional investors that they're each able to command a $40,000 annual subscription fee for their institutional advisory services. And they've also both been among our most popular guests ever in their past Macro Voices interviews. So this week, we're bringing you both Raoul and Julian together for the sake of getting contrasting views from two different experts on several different macro topics. We'll discuss the U.S. dollar's recent weakness and where it's headed from here, the equity market outlook, treasury yields, a topic where Raoul and Julian's views diverge considerably, demographics, and a whole lot more. When we taped this interview, it started going well beyond our usual time budget, but the content was so good, there's no way I was going to stop it in the middle. So you can expect this week an unusually long feature interview, close to an hour of Raoul and Julian, and then we'll have an abbreviated post-game segment.
And I'm Patrick Serezna. Now, Eric, let's take a look at that S&P 500. We had that extraordinary move last week where the market had that plunge. And then since then, the market's been very range-bound, doing almost nothing, hovering around 2468 right now as we're recording. What's your feeling on the S&P 500 here?
Well, as I've said many times before, I think it's a waste of breath to even talk about how overvalued the market is on a fundamental basis. You could have said that a year ago. The question to ask is, what is the event that's going to cause the liquidity to dry up so that we don't have more money to buy it up even further and make it even more overvalued? Well, certainly the chorus is getting louder. We're hearing more and more very famous people saying, okay, folks, this is getting crazy. We're really at a ridiculous level here. If you look at it from a technical standpoint, on a lot of technical charts, we're hitting the top of channels and so forth. So I think that some kind of a pullback is got to be somewhere in the cards, at least in the next couple of months. I don't know exactly when. I don't think anybody does. But you know, Patrick, the thing that I've been really thinking a lot about is the number of guests that we've had on the program saying, you know, the people that talk to institutions every day, that's how they make their living. They're saying, look, everybody I'm talking to is praying for a 10% dip so that they can buy it. And there's no doubt in my mind, Patrick, that if we were to have a 10% correction that played out in the usual way that people are used to, where it takes 3 or 4 weeks and we end up down 10% on the S&P, I have no doubt that people would start buying it in earnest because everybody is waiting for that 10% healthy correction. And I underscore the word healthy. But if I look at this market structure and I look at some of the things that we've been seeing, such as that little flash crash in tech stocks a few weeks ago, the fact that high frequency trading has put the traditional providers of liquidity essentially out of business, the fact that we're seeing so many signs in this market that liquidity could dry up very quickly, that ETFs could unwind, that you could have a panic situation. The thought exercise that I would recommend is this. Let's assume that we know for a fact that a normal 10% correction playing out over 3 weeks would result in everybody buying hand over fist. Now try this on for size. What if that 10% correction in the S&P 500 played out in 30 minutes? And I think that is possible, Patrick, if you look at what could happen if the high-frequency trader, algorithmic traders, suddenly dried up. We don't have the market makers, the human market makers in the system anymore. If this were all to happen at a time that there were other news events or something that were, and it could be a catalyst, such as a debt ceiling debate going the wrong way. What if you had that 10% correction in 30 minutes? How much of a hurry would people be in to buy that? And I think that's where the outlier case could be. A normal correction, I think it's going to be bought just like people have predicted. If you were to see a sudden drying up of liquidity, as happened in 87, where it was, 22% in basically a day and a half, I think that could be the thing that becomes self-reinforcing and gets out of control. I'm not saying it's a prediction, it's going to happen. As far as generally, aside from that scenario, what am I looking for? The godsend, to, as far as I'm concerned, to traders would be if we saw a melt-up and a parabolic rise to 2,600 or 2,650 by the end of this month, by the end of August. Why? Because that would be a sell signal. That is your parabolic blow-off top. But what we're seeing right now is the market continuing to grind higher, and what just despite all fundamental analysis to the side, looks like a perfectly healthy bull trend. So I guess if I look at all of this, what's it going to take? What's the catalyst that might cause gravity to set in here? I think the debt ceiling debate is definitely a candidate. For anybody who's not familiar, the way this works is that Congress has until the end of September to either extend the debt ceiling or come up with some workaround. Otherwise, the government shuts down. So there's only 6 weeks to work this out. What does Congress do in order to cope with that six-week deadline? They take a month off and come back when there's only 2 weeks left. So it will be interesting in early September. It's guaranteed to be some fireworks. Maybe that is an event that triggers a change in this market. Remember, though, that we also have what I think is a bullish factor, and it's a bullish perception factor, not a reality factor, which is what's coming is the Fed's balance sheet. When they start to unwind that Fed balance sheet, it's going to induce yield curve steepening. And it's not the kind of yield curve steepening that indicates that we have a strong, healthy economy. It's going to be a very different message. Most people won't take it that way. The masses will be misled to say, oh, steepening yield curve, strong economy, bull market. So that could help to propel us higher until eventually people figure out that that yield curve is steepening for all the wrong reasons. Raul and Julian are going to have plenty to say about this, so we'll save the meat of it for the feature interview. In general, though, my feeling is this is a really good time to be raising cash. And if you just feel that you can't miss out on that upside that might still be there, you listen to Martin Armstrong say this market is already overvalued, but it could double from here. Okay, why not sell your equities, raise cash, and buy some call options so that you know how much you can lose? Usually there's a downside to that. You got to pay for that optionality in the form of the option premium. Well, guess what? The VIX is telling us that that optionality is super cheap right now. It's at all-time low prices. So I think if you want to play the upside, think about doing it in a way where you're protected if something were to turn around. I'm not saying the market's going to crash. I just think that the upside from here, if you're going to play it at all, do it with options.
Now, Eric, let's move on to that dollar index, because we obviously have been talking about how oversold it is, but it seems like every single day that dollar index takes a fresh new tick lower. What's your feeling about the dollar here?
As our regular listeners know, my view to date has been buy the dip. I'm just not sure where that dip is. Where is it going to bottom? A lot of technicians are saying 92 even is a good bottom target for the dollar index. We're almost there. We think the low trade right now looks like it was 92 spot 30-something or 40-something. So, you know, we're already, we've seen a low 92 handle. As we're speaking on Thursday afternoon, we're back to a high 92 handle. Maybe we'll get down to 92 even. But, you know, I go back to who's gotten the call right recently on the dollar index. Juliet de Klerk is the person who's really nailed it. I got permission. We talked about Juliet in last week's show. I've been in touch with Juliet this week, and we were able to get permission. Obviously, her institutional research is intended for her institutional subscribers. She can't share it with the world, but in this case, she was able to agree to give me some back issues of her letters to her subscribers. So on February 22nd, she first laid out in detail her bearish case for the U.S. dollar. She definitely predicted this pullback that we've seen. And then on July 26th, she has another letter out, Patrick, believe it or not, saying she's looking for a bounce here as an opportunity to get back into the dollar short because she thinks that it's going lower still, particularly against the euro. Now, because that July 26th letter to her subscribers is more than 10 days old now and a little bit of arm twisting, I was able to get permission to share that with our listeners. You'll find the download link in your research roundup email. To summarize Juliet's view, the way she sees this is what is allowing the risk-on environment that we see in equity markets to continue as long as it has is weakening of the dollar. And she thinks that's why the dollar is weakening. And what she's saying is at some point, it has to come to an end. We have to get to risk off. That results in the Fed easing, and eventually that results in a weaker dollar. So she sees it as self-reinforcing. Now, on the other hand, Raul Paul and Julian Brigden, last we talked to them, had a very bullish secular view on the U.S. dollar. So not only am I going to ask them for their view, but I'm also going to hit them up and ask them to contrast their view with Juliet's view, as I've forwarded both of those letters to Raul and Julian. So look forward to this upcoming interview for much more depth on the U.S. dollar.
All right. Well, Eric, let's move on to crude oil. Now, crude oil has been above the $48 for a week or more, and we see this kind of thrust higher, and then it sells right back down, but it's still holding above that area. What's your feeling about crude oil here?
Well, here's how I see the big picture. The top of this cycle, if you look at where the trend line should have been, you would have expected somewhere 48, 48.50 in there somewhere. Probably should have been the top, and I would have looked for a reversal to the downside. We didn't get it. Why not? I think the answer is Venezuela hype, and I emphasize the word hype. The talk about sanctioning Venezuela and prohibiting the import of Venezuelan crude oil into the United States is really not that big of a deal, not that big of a threat, I don't think, because Venezuela could sell that crude oil to other places. And in fact, there was actually, I saw an item on the news this morning saying Citgo had already announced that they were going to export their crude to other countries, just with anticipating that there might be some kind of sanction. So I don't think that there's an oil sanction that's really coming. So failing the Venezuela situation really going crazy somehow, if Venezuela were to go offline and stop producing oil, that would change everything for sure. We could easily see $5 to $10 of upside in front-month prices in the short term if that happened. I don't think it's going to happen. The Venezuela sanctions are over and done with. It was economic sanctions against the president. And it is a very, very crazy situation there. And I guess that's what I should emphasize is, even though I don't think that oil sanctions per se are likely to come into the fray, give you a sense, I talked to a friend of mine who is Venezuelan, living outside of Venezuela. He's very involved in organizing the voting of Venezuelan citizens living outside of the country so that they could participate in this vote. And he told me that in Chile, which is an important country because it's a very immigration-friendly country that attracts a lot of people fleeing from Venezuela. So a lot of Venezuelans in Chile. And my friend told me that when they held polls for this election there, they got way more turnout than they even thought they had citizens living in the country. There were about 30,000 people in Santiago alone that showed up, Venezuelan citizens, to vote. Another 2,000 or so in Viña del Mar and Valparaíso, which are the beach towns close to Santiago, where there's also a Venezuelan population. He told me between the two of them, they had about 31,500. And I said, well, tell me, how many did you get on each side of this? And he says, well, voting with Maduro for changing the constitution, we got six. And I said, okay, 6,000 against out of 31, so that'd be 25. He says, no, Eric, you don't get it. There were 31,500 people, six votes, as in one more than five, four less than 10, a total of six votes for changing the Constitution. The other 31,450 or whatever it is, all said no way. Then the next morning, Maduro claims victory and says he won. So I guess the counting inside of Venezuela is on different arithmetic than the counting that occurred outside of Venezuela. So it is a big wild card. The situation there is just horrific. My heart goes out to the people that are living there and coping with the situation. There's hunger and starvation and horrible things. If that were to result in Venezuelan oil production going offline, at least in the short term, you could easily see a move up to $60 or even $70. But I think it would be short-lived. I think that Venezuela would be brought back online because it doesn't make economic sense to leave it offline. And, you know, if you want to look at geopolitical escalation, North Korea is the more likely escalation, but I don't see any direct relationship to oil. Probably there would be a spike in energy prices if there was a North Korean conflict. Certainly in any war situation, there's a demand increase for petroleum products. But as far as taking production offline, the way a Middle East conflict would happen, I just don't see a connection there. Raul Paul has done a lot of work on crude oil as well, so I'm going to ask him for an update on his bearish views on crude oil in the feature interview.
All right, well, let's move on to gold. Now, gold is trading around 1267, about the same level it was trading at last week when we did the show. And so we haven't really seen a big breakout in either way. But do you think gold moves higher from here, or is this just a short-term bounce that is still going to have some lower retesting?
It's all about the dollar index is my answer. What's my answer on the dollar index? I'm not sure. Listen to the feature interview. Maybe we can touch base on the dollar index again after the feature interview. But I think that it's really about that. This chart looks pretty strong to me. On the other hand, there's a strong inverse correlation between gold and the dollar, and a lot of technicians are saying that this dollar sell-off ends at 92 on the DXY, and we're almost there. So that would be the risk to a bull view, is that the dollar route is over and the dollar is about to rally again. That would create a headwind for gold.
So, Eric, let's move on to the 10-year treasury yields. The last week we were hovering around the 230, 232 levels, and suddenly we find ourselves down at the 222 level on the yields. What's your feeling on interest rates here?
Well, we're still bouncing around in the middle of this range. The trading range, as I see it, is 212 to about 242. We're in the middle of that. To my surprise, as I mentioned last week, Juliet DeClercq did take profits on her position, so she's out of the long treasury trade now. This is another area where it's interesting to me that Raul and Julian disagree, so their views are going to be coming up in the feature interview.
All right, thanks for that market wrap, Eric. Now, before moving on, I just wanted to take an opportunity to thank all of those listeners that took the time to rate and review us on iTunes as we requested last week. Our goal was to stay in the top 100 business podcasts because that status makes it much easier for me to recruit the very best feature interview guests. So please, if you haven't already, take a few minutes to rate and review us on iTunes. Just log into the iTunes store, look up the Macro Voices podcast in the search box, and then click on the blue square Macro Voices logo under the podcast headings. From there, click the ratings and reviews and click on write a review. If you use an Android phone and aren't on iTunes, unfortunately, to our knowledge, there's no way to submit an iTunes review other than through iTunes itself. But we do appreciate your help on other fronts, such as telling your friends and colleagues about the show. With that out of the way, joining us as this week's featured interview guest is Raul Paul, founder of Global Macro Investor and co-founder of Real Vision Television, and Julian Brigden, founder of MI2 Partners. Eric's interview with Raul and Julian is coming up as Macro Voices continues right here at macrovoices.com.
And now with this week's special guest, here's hedge fund manager Eric Townsend.
Joining me now are not just one, but two of our most popular guests ever to appear on Macro Voices. Raul Paul is the founder and principal of Global Macro Investor and a co-founder of Real Vision Television. Julian Brigden is the founder of MI2 Partners. Now, gentlemen, the two of you are both members of a very elite club. You both run institutional advisory services, and you've reached a pinnacle in your career to the point where you're able to command a $40,000 annual subscription fee for your advice. Great work if you can get it, so congratulations. But if there's anything that
I've learned
in this game, it is that contrasting views from more than one expert is worth more than the sum of the parts, because guys at your level are so persuasive that sometimes it's hard to see the other view. So I just want to let our listeners know that I have asked both of you to try to emphasize any areas where you might disagree or see things differently, and try to give us those contrasting views. Now, to get started, something that the three of us share in common is that we have all articulated secular bullish views about the U.S. dollar, both here on Macro Voices as well as on Real Vision Television. But while the three of us seem to agree, so we can pat our heads for that, it seems like Mr. Market is telling us a very different story, at least in the recent short term. The dollar index now 10 full big points below its cycle highs from just a few weeks ago. So let's start there. What's going on? Did we get it wrong on the secular call? Is this just a bigger than expected temporary pullback? And what can we expect from here with the dollar as we're now trading on a 92 handle? Raul, why don't we start with your view?
Yeah, my view, like yours, is bullish dollars. Now, the problem is we've only had two dollar bull markets in history, one in the early 80s and one in the late 90s. So we have a very small data sample to look at the behavior of dollar bull markets. But what I did note is no dollar bull market has had a weekly close down more than 10%. Once it goes more than 10%, it's generally a reversal. So that's a kind of, not so much a line in the sand, but a guideline for me. Now, we're very much there now. We're about 9.5% negative on a weekly basis. So it's starting to make me concerned. There's plenty of kind of support levels around here as well. I use DMARC indicators, and they are counting towards a reversal. We know that the market positioning is very high. So for me, it's really crucial that the dollar does hold. I think the underlying basis for why the dollar bull market should still be in play is still there. But what we need is some sort of change of sentiment within the market, whether it's either a renewed belief in much faster rate rises in the US or it's weaker economic growth. The dollar has a kind of smile where it rallies in either or, but falls when you're in the Goldilocks phase, which we've been having recently. So I'm looking at that. I'm obviously nervous on my view because it has been going against me. And I've been in the trade for a long, long time now. So in euro terms, it's about 148.5. So I'm now really finessing the idea is, does it move further than here? If we look at the previous dollar bull markets, they tend to go much further. So it would tend to suggest there's maybe another 15 or 20% upside in the dollar over time. I also look at, and something we'll probably talk about later, the comparison between this dollar bull market and the dollar bull market leading into the 90s is remarkably similar. The pattern almost fits exactly. And that was the period going into 1999 where we had a correction in the dollar. At that time, it went to about 8.5%. And then it turned around and started rallying as economic growth started falling and rates started easing off a bit. The Europeans at the time were raising rates still. And that whole scenario, we saw actually the dollar go much, much higher. And so that's what I'm looking for. If I'm wrong, the world is a different place. And there's a number of trade opportunities from that. But I still remain a dollar bull, but a nervous one.
So I think one of the things, look, I would concur pretty much with everything that Raoul said. I think one of the observations that I would make is that we've got to be a little bit careful of what we call a dollar. Because I think there's a great temptation to look at some of the dollar indexes and particularly the euro and say, well, that's indicative of what the dollar is doing. And I don't really believe that that is the case. I think, you know, we have been as a shop very bullish. And I think it was on your show, Eric, talking about how we saw the growth pickup coming in Europe. We were singularly bullish the dollar back in end of April, beginning of May for our clients. Singularly bullish the euro end of April, beginning of May for our clients. And that was on the break of we started to see break above 108 in the euro. And in actual fact, we just advocated 24 hours ago to sort of start taking profits in those long euro positions. But the point is that things like the DXY are essentially euros. I mean, they've got some Swiss francs in there, some Swedish krona, and those are both pegged effectively to the euro. So you really, I think you have to be a bit careful. I think what we've seen a lot this year is a repricing of the growth inflation story in Europe. And I think that's one of the reasons why the dollar has been underperforming. So I'm not quite as concerned about this 10% line in the sand, and I know the sand that I think Raoul makes some good observations on that. But I would say that I think to get the next kicker, we need to see some developments of the story here in the US. We're either going to have to see and this is my fear, we're going to see a risk-off dollar rally. So you could have a situation where you can get a correction in bond markets and a correction in equities, and you can actually get the dollar rising because it's a safe haven vehicle. Or we move into the latter half of the year, we get the Fed to start to shrink the balance sheet. I've talked to your listeners about this before. I think that's potentially a very bullish event, and particularly as well in early 2018 if we get the Trump tax cut. And my sources in DC tell me that there's still the odds, even though Trump doesn't seem to be able to put his trousers on straight any day of the week, that the odds are somewhere around 65-70% that we get a tax deal, and it will definitively include repatriation. So I think to me, I'm still in that structural bull environment for the dollar, but we may have quite a few months to wait still. And in that interim, I think what we're doing is just repricing the euro.
Now I'd like to follow up on the topic of the dollar by asking both of you for your reaction to an opposing view. Another member of that $40,000 a year institutional advisors club is our mutual friend Juliet DeClercq. Back on February 22nd, Juliet sent her clients a short trade recommendation against the dollar. She got that call right and has since taken profits. But much more recently, on July 26th, she sent her clients another letter recommending that they look for a bounce as an opportunity to re-enter the short trade. Now, while those letters are obviously intended only for her paying institutional clients, Juliet was gracious enough to allow allow us to share both of them with our Macro Voices listeners now that they're both at least 10 days old. So you can find links to that, listeners, in your Research Roundup email. So I want you guys just to imagine that I'm, you know, one of your institutional clients saying, hey, I really respect both of your work, but we all respect Juliet too. And to summarize, listeners, you can find Juliet's view in detail in that download link. But to summarize it for anyone who doesn't have the link, Juliet's saying, look, what is the one thing that is allowing the risk on condition to continue so long when so many people are calling for risk off? It's the weak dollar. What happens when we finally get risk off? It's going to be Fed easing, and that means weaker dollar. So she sees this as a self-reinforcing situation that's only going to take the dollar lower. What would you say to that if you were advising one of your institutional clients who has maybe a client of your service as well as Juliet?
Okay, so I'll kick off with this one. Is firstly, it is provable that in the last two dollar bull markets, the movement of interest rates was not the defining factor in the movement of the dollar. So interest rates rose and fell over the last two dollar bull markets. Generally, interest rates fell when the dollar moved higher. So I do not believe it's interest rate driven. There is some element of interest rate differential driven, which is one of the key themes that Julian has been looking at. The other thing that's crucially important to understand is, what is Juliet's time horizon? You know, both mine and Julian's time horizon in the structural dollar bull market view, it's a multi-year thing. So, you know, I'm still looking for the last 2 years of a dollar bull market, maybe 18 months. And I think Julian's probably looking for similar. Now, Juliet is more trading orientated, which is more in the same time horizon that Julian operates more in. And Julian very correctly called this rally in the euro. So I don't think there's much difference between Julian and Juliet. I tend to be much longer term in how I look about things. So I'm less interested in going against my view by selling dollars in the interim as the dollar weakens. I'm more interested in adding to the trade again once we get to interesting levels.
Anything to add, Julian?
Yeah, I mean, I think what Juliet's essentially talking is she's saying, you know, look, we can get a correction you get a dollar bounce, but you're supposed to fade it because the Fed will just ease again. And I have some sympathy with that. I mean, I think that's their proclivity and their inclination to try and do that. However, I think we're getting to a very interesting point in the dollar. And I think, you know, to Raoul's point, both he and I have got a very long-term structural view of the dollar. And our structural view of the dollar is there simply have been too many borrowed and there aren't enough being supplied, right? And I think we've gone through that with your listeners before. I mean, I in particular see this collapse in the current account deficit as a structural problem for the dollar. I mean, I really think that, you know, and I laugh continuously whenever I hear comments from the Trump administration talking about wanting to run a flat current account deficit. And you can't do that and be the reserve currency. But, you know, we have had a significant reduction in the U.S. current account deficit courtesy of shale oil and import substitution. And as a result, we are structurally not supplying the world with enough dollars. What's prevented the crisis, even though we've had these spasmodic sort of bursts of dollar strength and emerging market in particular weakness, is that we've had this huge capital flow, which has been driven by the expansion of the Fed's balance sheet. So essentially, current account deficit shortfall offset by capital outflows. The problem is the Fed wants to start shrinking the balance sheet. And at the same time, as I said, we are contemplating doing this tax deal sometime early next year, where we're talking about repatriating trillions of dollars. I just think that to me, and I think when I was in that camp, that to me means that the biggest risk out there is that we get one final rally in the dollar sometime starting in Q1, Q2 of next year. And it may start slightly before then, but I think the big risk is that repatriation money. And that when that happens, it will be a destructive dollar rally. It will be a risk-off dollar rally of inordinate proportions. The other thing that I'm a bit cautious about, Eric, as I said, is that in the near term, I'm actually quite worried about this focus that people have got on, you know, the dollar. Well, and they look at the euro, and they look at euro dollar as that. And one of the things that I've been worried about increasingly is the mispricing that I see. The biggest mispricing I see out there is in the European bond market. And I know we're going to talk about bonds in a second. But I would draw you in FX, I would draw your listeners' attention to events in the spring of 2015, where not only did you end up with euro strength against the dollar, but you also ended up with dollar strength against virtually everything else. So the dollar rose against the Kiwi, the dollar rose against the Aussie, the dollar rose against the Canadian, the dollar rose against EM. But the euro was strong because what you had was a risk-off event triggered by a bond correction in Europe. And so I really, really would caution your listeners not to just say, this is the dollar, because the dollar has got lots of different guises, and you have to watch them and focus on them very carefully.
We'll come back to fixed income in a minute, but let's start with the equity market outlook. So many people, including Raul right here on this program, have argued that, hey, we're just way long overdue for an end of this extended business cycle. It's time for a recession. It's time for a resurgence of volatility in markets. But that was a year ago, and the market just marches higher and higher. So how does this eventually end?
Well, for me, I go back to the business cycle. You know, we looked at it last year and the business cycle weakened significantly, gained traction again and bounced again. I mean, it's done this a couple of times now, and it's tiresome, but it is what it is. Because I much prefer it when we get to the bottom of a cycle, we know when to invest, etc. But, you know, waiting for this is slightly painful. But until economic growth weakens in any meaningful way, the equity market will continue to grind higher, volatility will remain low, until something changes. Now, there is, and that's structural volatility, there is opportunities, and I think Julian will talk a bit about this, for spiky volatility, where, you know, there is an opportunity for a risk off, which may not be pervasive and may not last very long. We won't get anything that lasts long, and we won't get a structural shift in volatility until the business cycle weakens. Now, I think it's peaked out again. So I think in line with Julian's timing, we'll be looking at another very weak quarter in Q1, Q2, and let's see how the economy looks at that phase. There is an opportunity, I think, if you look how the NASDAQ trades, some of the tech stocks, various other bits and pieces, you know, looking how General Electric's trading, how the oil companies are trading, that there is a potential for a risk-off event in the short term, definitely. But the structural one, it's not here yet, I don't think.
And Julian?
So I think, look, I mean, once again, I'd sort of differentiate. I mean, we were long and advocated to clients not long after we got, I think, on your show. We talked about this European strength, and we'd advocated to our paying clients to get long European stocks back in beginning of December. And then we got out about a month ago, just because we'd had this incredibly good run. We think that a lot of the outperformance of the European stock market have been predicated on euro weakness and also low bond yields. And both of those we think are in the process of changing. So we've scaled back our belief in the sort of European outperformance trade at this stage. I think the US equity market, we seem to be going through this big game of rotation. And I think, once again, you've got to differentiate between markets, you know, in the same way that you can't look at the dollar as just a single thing. What we've got is we've had up until the last week or so, really very aggressive outperformance by a relatively narrow group of stocks. And those stocks, and, you know, we've talked about it in a number of publications, are increasingly looking like what I would call a classic bubble. And I think I've talked on your show about a classic bubble, and it's just this chart pattern we look for, Eric. But if you look at the likes of Amazon, Nvidia, and these sorts of names, and even Bitcoin, you can make a case that we're in the sort of end of the parabolic phase, or it looks to be getting closer to the end of the parabolic phase. And the key thing that I would say to people is, look, you know, you certainly don't short anything in a parabolic phase. It's you know, the inverse of trying to catch a falling knife. What you do, though, is you run your risk very tight in that phase, because just like the jet fighter that's going off to the moon, or appears to be, and it goes vertical, there comes a point where the jets literally ran out of oxygen. And at that point, the thing doesn't go sideways. It drops hard. And so when I look at some of these tech stocks, I think that's the danger that we're facing here. Yes, at the moment, we're getting rotation into the Dow. But to me, rotating into the safety stocks is not indicative of a bull market. That's what we did in 2000. Now, that topping pattern went on for a long time. And I think I'm not in it believing that we're going to get some sort of catastrophic sell-off in the US. I can construct a scenario where we get a really nasty sell-off in Europe. And we could talk about that in a second, because it's very linked to the bond story. But the US, I think, needs to go through this extended topping pattern. And this is beginning to feel quite reminiscent of 2000. And if you remember, in the spring of 2000, the NASDAQ topped. The money rotated out of that and went into the S&P. And the S&P stayed up until September of 2000. And then the money left that one and rotated into the super safe Dow. And it stayed there until May of 2001. And only when the Dow cracked in May of 2001 did we get a broad bear market in the US. And so I think we could be going through the initial stages of that rotation out of these high beta tech stocks. And some of that money will go into the S&P, but probably more, and it'll be a quicker rotation, I think, than it was back in 2000, because the composition of the indexes will go into the Dow. But I just really struggle with bonds, the divergence between bonds and equities. And that, to me, is the biggest problem. Equities are only up here because bond yields are so low. And if you correct bond yields to where I think they need to go, then it's quite hard for equities to stay at this current level, even if it's on the basis of economic growth.
Let's go ahead then and come back to that topic. I can tell you're itching to get to it, Julian, where I think you guys may disagree a little bit, which is fixed income in general and treasury yields in particular. Raul, I enjoyed your interview recently on Real Vision Television with Hugh Hendry, who was very quick to compliment you on your timing and so brilliantly making the bull call on buying treasury bonds. But then he kind of looked at you in his Scottish way and said, Raul, you're still calling for 50 basis points? Are you crazy? Are you still calling for 50 basis points, Raul, on the U.S. 10-year? And where is this headed from here?
Yeah, again, you need to talk about path and you need to talk about time horizon. So for me, the path is I'm less interested in. I think it's a pretty benign environment for U.S. rates. Yes, if Trump does manage to pass something in terms of economic stimulus, in terms of some sort of fiscal policy or taxation, whatever it may be, then, you know, can rates back up a bit? Yeah. But for me, I'm indifferent from a backup in rates from, you know, 225 where they are today at 10 years to, you know, 275, 50 basis points. I don't really care, because I think the risk reward is that at the bottom of the business cycle, which we've identified that has to come and will come within the next, call it 18 months, the bottom of the business cycle should see bond yields at 50 basis points or even less. So that makes, even with a backup in yields to, let's say, 275, it still makes it kind of a 5-for-1 risk reward. So for me, I look through the speed bumps and look at the horizon. The horizon for me is 50 basis points at the bottom of the next business cycle, which has to come. Well, it doesn't have to come, but the probability is extremely high that it comes in the next 18 months or 2 years.
So your view is still secular, very much bullish on bonds, bearish on bond yields. Julian, I think you have a very different view.
Yeah, and it's not. It is, Eric. I mean, it's certainly in the next, we say, 6 months. And I think it's, you know, Raul and I talk about this a lot. And, you know, it's one of the things that I think we believe is one of the strengths of the product. We tend to sort of chew through our stories. And our views are structurally very, very similar. But often our timelines are slightly different how we get there. And my concern is I can ultimately think Raul's right. I mean, I think we could get another very nasty downturn. I think we could get it's hard to argue against the sort of structural deflationary trends or disinflationary trends that you see globally. The question is how do you get to that next crisis? Do you sort of go quietly into the night and we walk in one day and ISM's at 45 and everyone says, wow, you know, QE doesn't work and the equity market sells off? Or do you get there a different way? And my inclination is I believe we actually get there a slightly different way. And at the moment, the biggest risk that I see in markets is this chasm between, as I said, equity market pricing and bond pricing. And with that, you can throw in vol. And my biggest fear is that we're going to get to the next crisis, not via immediate economic weakness, but actually via strength. And it isn't so much in the US. As I said, I think there's a chance that we get a burst of very aggressive activity sometime in 2018 if we get this Trump stimulus through. But when I look at the world, actually, my biggest fear, and I think this is interesting for U.S. Listeners of yours, because generally Americans generally don't look too broadly at the rest of the world. They tend to be very focused, certainly the financial networks tend to be very focused on what's going on in the U.S. I actually think the biggest risk is Europe. I look at my European growth models, and we've talked about this, but these things continue to strengthen. And the inflation picture actually, I think, is just really going to rip. And I was reading today how one of my peers was talking about how for the fourth time, the ECB is going to have to upgrade their growth forecasts. Well, I just think they're going to have to keep upgrading and upgrading their growth forecasts. And what I fear is that we're on the cusp of a repeat of events that we saw in the spring of 2015. So if you remember at that point, the ECB had launched QE in the end of 2014. The DAX had ripped higher and bund yields were locked at zero. And then one day we walked in and the bund market finally said, screw this for a game of soldiers. I am repricing because what's the point of holding bunds at zero if this DAX is going to the stratosphere? And when I look at positioning and I look at the beginning of the winding down of the program and potentially the fact that the ECB is going to be forced to actually accelerate that wind down of the program, that's exactly the risk that I see. I actually see the risk of a rapid repricing in the European bond market. I think that will actually push global bond yields as it did in 2015 higher. Now, they won't rise as much in the US as they're going to rise in Europe. But I also think that that can create a broad risk-off environment, because if you reprice bunds significantly higher, then you have to raise your dividend yield on the DAX. And the most obvious way that you do that is actually by lowering prices. And so to my immediate concern is you get to that ultimately weaker end game from strength, not just insipid weakness where we just sort of roll down there, because I'm just not seeing it in my models.
Let's touch briefly on gold. We've seen what surprised me, actually, in terms of some strength recently in the chart. Where do you guys think this is headed? Start with Raoul.
Look, again, using my long-term horizon, I think gold is going to double from here at least. The question is the path. If we see the dollar gain some traction, I think gold will sell off again. If the dollar is truly weaker for longer, then gold will break out. But what you really want to do is buy the next correction in gold. Either way, it's either broken out or it's still within the range. But you buy that correction because as you go towards the end of the business cycle, the central banks are going to be forced back into action, back in expanding balance sheet. And at that point, I believe gold will do much better than most people expect. It's been a slow base building for gold, which is lovely because when charts do this kind of thing, it tends to mean that the move is explosive over time. And I have a feeling that gold and the dollar will rally together as safe haven assets into the next bottom of the business cycle. In the interim, as I said, if the dollar is weaker than I expect or the three of us expect, then gold is going to go higher. But I don't think that rally will have the kind of momentum it would have if this were a risk-off environment. And gold will get a bid as people start to realize the central banks are going to have to go much larger than we ever expected. And if there is a recession on the horizon at some point, again, it's not here, it's not now. If it is, then the Europeans are going to be involved. The Japanese are going to be involved. The Chinese are going to be involved. And the US is going to be involved. That is not particularly good for fiat currency and tends to be extremely bullish for gold.
And Julian, your view with particular emphasis on, do you agree with Raoul's unusual take that the dollar and gold, which are normally inversely correlated, can rally together as safe haven assets?
Yeah, I mean, look, I would say that I've been somewhat agnostic on precious metals. I think you had me on before and I said, I'm just at this point of the cycle, I'm just not that fast enough. But I would concur with Raoul's, if you get this dip in gold, and one of the ones that I look at very closely is silver. I mean, if you go and look at silver, we once again came down to a trend line that's basically held the up move since the beginning of 2002. And so that was, just around sort of $15. So I don't mind having a small position in at this point. I'm not a structural bull right here, though. And that is because I still think that we've got that burst of dollar strength. And I think initially, at least, you're going to get a burst of higher yields. And that, to me, would be the best time that I would want to buy gold. So I think, I totally concur with Raoul longer term. I think if we do end up with a very nasty downturn again. As I said, I think it comes about from a burst of strength and inflation where the central banks are actually forced to be more aggressive and they tip the whole system back over again, only to then have to turn out to themselves and be very dovey. That, to me, is going to be the best opportunity to pick up precious metals, because I think, and I do concur with Raoul, that people are really going to start to lose some faith in fiat currencies at that point, because the whole thing is just going to look like a total sham.
Let's move on to a subject I know Raoul has done a huge amount of work on, which is demographics. Baby boomers are retiring. And, you know, Japan went through this about 15 years earlier than the United States, and there's a lot of lessons there. In terms of both the general picture of what are the market implications of the baby boomers retiring, as well as the more specific subject of is there an impending pension crisis? Raoul, why don't we start with you?
Yeah, look, this is what I love about demographics. Is it is 100% forecastable. You know, you're not going to suddenly find a whole group of the population didn't know existed. We know what they're going to do, how old they're going to get, when they're going to retire, give or take a few years. What we've seen is the average American, let's use America as the easiest example, the average American is retiring, is extending their retirement. However, the baby boomers are starting to hit 70 and a half, and for tax purposes, it makes it advantageous for them to retire. So we've got, over the next 15 years, nothing but retirees. The largest group of people in the history of America and the history of the Western world retiring at the same time. Now, what is interesting is you can go forwards and forecast using demographics, things like the labor force participation rate. Now, what it tells you is that we've had a steady period over the last few years where the labor force participation rate's been going sideways. But going forwards, it's going to fall off a cliff as these retirees leave the labor force and they're not being replaced because the millennials are already in the workforce. So we've got this huge problem coming. Now, why is that a problem? It's because it correlates incredibly well with some key metrics. Interesting enough, if I look at consumption, the growth of consumption basically is the labor force participation rate. The Fed balance sheet, the labor force participation rate. Long-term inflation rates, labor force participation rate. Even gasoline sales, labor force participation rate. And if you think about it, and I've talked about this frequently in the past, if you think about it, think what retirees do. My father retired, I guess it's about 10 years ago now. He was about 60 at the time. 65. So 15 years ago, he retired. 65 years old. So he was a relatively well-off guy, buy a new BMW every 2 or 3 years, and he'd spend money at fancy restaurants and a nice bottle of wine and some champagne at home. And, you know, not prolific spender, but, you know, that kind of, you know, middle class, had a good career kind of thing. So what happened when he retired? His saving patterns collapsed because he had now a finite amount of savings and he didn't know how long he'd live for. So you can't project. So you have to be conservative, because you can't project how long your income is going to last for. So what happens is his saving collapsed. And what happened is, as bond yield collapsed, his income collapsed too. So he spent less and less and less. My guess, he probably spends a quarter of what he did when he retired. Now, if you put that into the context of all of the baby boomers who are going to go through the same process, then that's catastrophic. The other issue that's outstanding is the baby boomers know that they have this funding problem because they never saved enough money. So the median American has about 180 grand saved up for his retirement, of which 50 grand is positive equity in his house. There's like 20 grand of savings maximum, and the rest is basically equity market exposure. There's a very small bond exposure. So they're going to go into retirement with a high allocation towards equities. And equities, as we know, tend to fall when the business cycle is weak. We're waiting for the next recession. It will come during the period when all of these baby boomers are starting to leave the workforce. They can't buy the dip any longer. They're actually forced sellers into a bear market because they need to protect their income because they will not be able to earn it back and buy back into the stock market. The millennials, they don't have enough money to buy the stock market. So we have a gap. This is really dangerous. It's very dangerous for people's savings, for their retirement planning. It's dangerous for consumption. It's dangerous for the economy. It's dangerous for inflation. So there's a number of things. I think it's the biggest, most important story over the next 10 years in the US and in Western Europe. This is all we'll be talking about.
And Julian, your reactions, and particularly, do you see a pension crisis as part of this?
No, look, I completely concur with Raoul. I mean, I think, you know, funnily enough, we just produced a piece that's just sent out this morning to our clients talking about Japan. And we've written a piece, you know, the other day where we talked about, you know, the Japanese policy in the markets. And then today's piece was Japanese policy in the real economy. And one of the conclusions was that, and we were looking at the demographics and we looked at the declining workforce. And to Raoul's point, you can take the declining workforce or the growth of the workforce through the 70s and into the 80s, into the 90s, peaking the beginning of sort of 2005, 2006, and then rolling over. And you can look at Japanese CPI. And you have to come to the conclusion that, look, I'm not a great fan of what the BOJ's done. I think they've slavishly followed the policies that have been promoted by the Fed and the ECB. And I just don't think they're necessarily applicable for Japan. And one of those factors is the aging population. But if you look at the fact that the BOJ has actually been able to hold inflation, even at these levels, let alone hit the 2% target, these guys deserve a huge round of applause for what they've even managed to achieve in the face of demographics that are absolutely imploding. I mean, people, you know, we produce this thing called the Japan Update, which was one of our sort of daily publications. And it's written by a friend of mine who's a complete Japanese specialist, you know, 35 years trading Japanese markets. And one of his favorite quotes is, if you look at the Japanese population between 2040 and 2060, it is going to decline by the same percentage as the European population dropped during the Black Death. just think of that from an expenditure perspective.
Julian, interesting enough, I've just been reading a book about the trading history of the world. It's called The Silk Road. Mm-hmm. It's a phenomenal book. They talked about Black Death. What was the outcome of Black Death in the end? Higher per capita GDP and faster GDP growth. It actually was a good thing.
And you did get, during the peasant revolution, you did get a bout of inflation because you lost so many workers that you had to pay them more. But, you know, the initial stage, just think of it like this. I mean, what will happen, of course, is we'll have robots that will actually replace them. But if you think about it like this, there is actually a point where, you know, if you're losing a third of your population, and you're losing, by default, a third of your consumption, how is that made up? Right. How do you fight that? Right. Do you fight it by giving people, you know, the remaining people a third more wages? Well, they're trying in Japan. It just hasn't succeeded. So, look, I think there are lots of these structural factors, and I totally believe what Raoul is saying, and I concur with him completely, in Western Europe and the US. It's just, for me, can we have that bout of excessive strength over the next 12 to 18 months? Right, before we get to that downturn, right? Can I sit here and say, I think the ECB's overcooked it. I can see rampant inflation and really robust growth that's going to catch the bond market in Europe offside. And, you know, that we have a spike in yields before the whole thing rolls over again. And I think that's Sod's law. What Sod's law would dictate, right? That it carts out the most people. And then you ultimately return to the real underlying trends, which are, you know, I don't like to use the word deflation, but disinflationary, let's say.
I think the point being is, whatever the outcome is in the slightly longer term, Julian and I agree. So what does that mean for the average guy? The average guy, it means their pension underfunding is going to be higher than anybody expects. We're already seeing a pension crisis in the public pension schemes across America and across Europe. But hidden beneath are people like GE and the oil companies and Ford and American Airlines and all these people who have these huge defined benefit pension schemes. Pensioners are expecting a return of X percent of their final salary. The reality is you cannot have this many people retiring, drawing benefits at the same time when the pension system is so underfunded because of low rates. They will not get those outcomes. So there's a dawning realization that has to come of people, which is everybody's consumption plans will change because they will not be able to retire on the wealth that they thought. And that's the pension crisis.
Let's move on now to a subject that's near and dear to my heart, which is crude oil. Real Vision subscribers know that Raul has done a series on this and has a short view, as I've had, on crude oil. Raul, what we've seen in the last month or so is that there's been a pretty good rally. I think that was a normal reaction rally back up towards its channel resistance line. But then we had what I think was a scare out of Venezuela that pushed us up above $50. My plan for this interview was to ask you, Raul, now that we're above $50, is that rare opportunity that you get to sell short above $50. Well, as we're taping on Wednesday mid-session, we're below $50 again. Looks to me like it may stay that way. What's your view? Is this an attractive point to enter that short trade? And do you still have the same outlook that you had in that series of videos?
Yeah, look, so there's two things here with oil that we need to be, three things. One was positioning, which you quite rightly said, this would be a normal correction because, you know, oil moved a long way. Okay, fine. The second part of it is the structural situation in oil any different? Is OPEC still overproducing? Yes. Are they putting all their oil in storage? Yes. Are we going through the seasonality where you see draws of inventories in the US and around the world? Yes. So we're expecting to see draws, but the underlying situation of far too much oil, wait till we get to winter and we'll see how fast they stack up the oil. I think they're going to end up with too much oil in storage, particularly in the US, as shale continues to pump out oil. So the structural situation is bearish, but then we've got the issue of the dollar because oil is priced in dollars. With dollar weakness, oil's going up, fact. So we need to get to this point where the dollar stabilizes or starts to rally, and then oil will also turn around. I too, like you, have a kind of sneaking suspicion that oil's pretty much done here. But if it doesn't, if the dollar continues to weaken, then oil's going to $70. And it's not my base case, but I'm cognizant of the risk and the rising probability that something may have changed. But my view remains, and I've been short since $57, I remain a bear on oil, and I think it goes much lower over time.
And Julian?
You know, we tend to sort of try and focus on things that we've really got a sort of, where we think we've got an objective advantage over people. And, you know, so we were very bearish on oil sort of it's 2014 onwards. And now, you know, I think, to be honest, I'm a little agnostic here. It's a bit like my precious metal view. And it's not that, you know, I also concur with Raul longer term. I mean, I think that when you look at the picture and you look at the moves that you've got, for example, you know, the UK and France now talking about having no fossil fuel led vehicles at all from 2040 onwards. Now, I know, you know, our president would like us to be able to have coal-fired cars. But I think, you know, the reality is that we're moving to a world where there are less use of carbons in transportation outside air travel. And so I think there's a structural problem there. I don't believe these shale boys are going away anytime soon. And in fact, I think that everything I hear is that they've been stepping stuff up so that, exactly to Raul's point, come the end of the year, there's going to be a flood of this stuff that's going to hit the market again. So I think that, you know, when I look at the sort of short-term dynamics, I think, you know, we can have this maybe a little bit further. And to Raul's point, you know, on the basis of perhaps a little bit more weakness in the dollar, we can push things back up into the very low 50s again. But, you know, I'm not a great bull. I just think, you know, if we were to push much above that, the shale boys will just, it'll be even worse 3 months down the line because they'll just pump even more oil. And I think the big bear market for me starts when the Saudis have floated Saudi Aramco. That's the point where I want to get really bearish on this thing.
Let's move on now to a piece that Raul wrote in Global Macro Investor. For people who are not subscribers to Real Vision Publications and don't have access to it, I'm going to ask Raul to first very briefly summarize what the gist of a piece that he wrote called Haven't I Seen You Somewhere Before, where Raul draws parallels between today and the lead up to 2000. If you could summarize that first, and then I'd like to ask Julian to get his reactions to it.
Very interesting. I was on Bloomberg and a message popped up from somebody I didn't know working for a hedge fund based out in Baltimore. And she said, hey, listen, Raul, I know you like this kind of stuff. You might be interested in this. and she sent me a pack of 50 charts. And what they all were random charts of economic patterns and asset prices versus the run-up to 2000. And they weren't just, you know, a few months of data. They were an extended period of 7 years similarity. And I stopped in my tracks. So then Remy, my analyst, and myself started piling through all the charts. And we looked at everything from the euro to the price of the euro to what happened to Australian exports, to Korean exports, to consumer confidence, consumer sentiment, industrial production, durable goods in Europe, the US, Asia, and all the charts are as close to identical as I've ever seen any historical pattern ever. And I think the charts, I've probably got well over 100 of these charts now showing the uncanny similarity going into 2000. And I think if you listen to the nuance of what Julian's been saying and what I've been saying, we both see similarities to that point. You know, into 2000, I think it was the ECB were raising rates. The DAX was falling. Europe peaked out much before. Julian talked about the rotation of stocks. The S&P matches very well. It would suggest that by slightly later in the year, maybe Q4, the S&P tops out as well. It would suggest, exactly as Julian said, that the NASDAQ goes first, then the S&P, and then maybe the Dow. Not quite clear. But the Dow, you know, just hitting new highs again. It looks like that's the kind of environment that we're going to see. Bond markets, almost identical as well. LIBOR, almost identical. Inflation rates, almost identical. I mean, everything. And these are, again, I'm not talking about 3 months look similarity or 1 year kind of vaguely similar. I'm talking about an almost perfect pattern match over a period of 7 years from one recession into the other. It's extraordinary. I've never seen anything like it. And normally I would discount those as interesting. But when you've got so many, it gives us a roadmap. I love a roadmap where we can prove whether we're right or wrong. It's suggesting, for example, that emerging markets should roll over soon. And I know Julian's been exactly on that theme, urging his subscribers to get out of some longs in emerging markets. It would suggest the top would be in and we'd get a much larger correction in emerging markets. It would suggest the top in equities overall in the US will be the last. It would suggest that the top that we've seen in the DAX is the top. And the economic growth going forwards should start weakening from here. We saw it in the ISM print. We're seeing it in the Chicago numbers. We're seeing it everywhere that it is actually following suit. So I'm going to continue to follow this as my roadmap. Not saying 100% it's definitely going to play out this way, but it gives us a very nice guideline of what could happen and how things move.
And Julian, your reaction?
No, look, I mean, I would take things a little further, actually. Eric, if you remember, and I think you were one of the people, you know, we definitely came onto the show and talked about how we expected bond yields to pick up in the US, right? If you remember back early last year, that was built on a cyclical pattern that we've seen in the past. There have been three, including the last one, major over the last sort of 30 years swings in oil prices, and they always pretty much elicit the same thing. So the first one was basically 85 into 87. It's quite a brief and violent one. The next one was 96 into 2000, and we just had one 2014 into now. And the pattern is always the same. It is always the same. You get a big drop in oil prices. Okay, in the US, you're obviously inflation, and globally, your inflation drops hard. Then what happens is that your sort of soft data, things like ISM, which are measurements of speed and not level of growth, also drop hard. And in both in the late 80s and in the late 90s, they skirted their almost recessionary levels in the sort of upper 40s. Then the central bank eases, the bond market rallies, and the equity market, you know, tends not quite to know what to do. If in the 80s it sort of went a little bit sideways initially, in the 90s we were, to some extent it did, and then we got into the bull run of the NASDAQ as money sort of tried to pick up the growth story. And that's a little bit more like we're doing now. But the point is you have this big rally in the bond market and you have this slowdown in the data. Then what happens is oil bases, and because we look at the rate of change of oil when we calculate inflation and not the level, we get this rapid rip in inflation. all your soft metrics, ISM, come rebounding back, what happens then is the economy comes surging back. At some point, the bond market starts to go, oh my goodness, starts to correct. Initially, the equity market takes it as well because it's got strong data behind it. And what we get is the equity market does very well. So between sort of the summer of beginning of 1987, for example, and September 1987, the S&P went up like 35%. Every single one of those events ended with a crash. And so to Raoul's point, I wouldn't say this just looks just like 2000. I actually think it looks like the late 80s as well, and which obviously ended with the 87 crash. And I think the parallels are exactly there. If I look at our cyclical models for the S&P, they show this thing is basically at the highs right here, right now. And starting in sort of October, November, we start to move quite materially lower, my work is suggesting. So I think this cyclicality goes further and lasts longer. And the parallels are even more acute than just 2000. But as I said, I'm looking for the final coup de grace to this bull market to come from a burst of hawkish central bank activity, or should we say a sell-off in the bond market caused by inaction of the central banks to actually react to stronger data. And I think that's how I get to the end game, Eric. It's not that I think we just slip there. I think we get, yeah, I need to get that tightening from either the central banks or the bond market to deliver that correction to the equity market. But I think it's coming.
I want to shift gears now to a different topic. As I mentioned earlier, the two of you guys are both in the business of providing institutional advisory services. Your views are so revered by your institutional clients that they're happy to pay a $40,000 annual subscription, which, of course, if you're running hundreds of millions of dollars, is a drop in the bucket because they make that back on one trade idea that they get from you. On the other hand, if you look at the retail market, all that really exists is there's a million and one of these, $200 to $500 per year retail investment letters, some good, some bad. Raoul, your partner Grant Williams writes one of the better ones, but there's a very limited market there. There's really not a lot between the $500 a year and the $40,000 a year institutional level. You've got a plan to change that. Tell us about it.
Yeah, look, if you remember when we started Real Vision, part of the mission that we have is to democratize financial information. It is not right that only the financial elites get the best information. And, you know, there's not that many newsletters, as you point out, at the kind of cheaper end of the market that's as high quality as Grant. There are a few, and some of those are on Real Vision publications, as you know. But really, to get kind of institutional quality macro research, that's an expensive business because it's very time consuming. It's very detailed, homework orientated. It's less storytelling and more this gigantic, ever moving jigsaw puzzle that Julie and I frantically try and solve at every point in our lives. But the idea is that Julie and I strongly thought that we could do something by giving a peek behind the curtain of what we do in Global Macro Investor and MI2 Partners, to give a peek behind the curtain of some of our work. That work is not really applicable to retail, but some of it is. It gives us an idea of our framework. And we can use our frameworks to generate investment ideas and some clarity for retail investors. Actually, it was an idea from one of our Real Vision subscribers. Said, you guys should get together because you're very similar in what you do, but you're different enough to be interesting and you'll have nuance. And we laughed about it because the last thing I ever want to do is anything with Julian. But now we decided that actually, you know, we're pretty complementary and we quite enjoy working together. So we launched Macro Insiders, and that's a $3,000 product. And that's still a hefty price target because really to be trading in these kind of macro themes, you need to have some reasonable investment money to be able to do so meaningfully. But it's a lot cheaper. It's a tenth of the price or less than the actual macro research of just one of us, let alone two of us combined. So we try to do it as cheaply as possible and as understandable, digestible and actionable as possible for the retail market. And so far, the feedback has been astonishingly good. It's just been, it was launched, end of last week was the final launch, and we're now up and running and going. Julian, do you want to explain a bit about the product?
Yeah, so essentially you're going to get four deliverables. So you get this piece called The Meeting of Minds. And The Meeting of Minds, we will give you And this, I think, is something unique. We're really going to give you a glimpse of what we give to our institutional clients. So essentially, you'll get a report from each of us, which we've shown to our institutional clients. And it's just, it is typically a more sort of structural thought piece. For example, Rael's written about the pension story. And we wrote about some of the risks associated with risk parity and balanced portfolios. So it's a structural piece. It's designed to make you sort of think and examine some of the underlying risks in your portfolio. Then you get two more actionable pieces, and you get those one a week. And those are called In Focus. And those are really meant to be, as Rael said, we've been discussing with people, look, we think emerging markets had a great run, but we think now these things are fully priced, and we would be looking at this point to increasingly take profit in some of our emerging market portfolios. And this is why, and we explain those. But they're really trade orientation, actionable stuff, and applicable to a retail investor, Eric. And I think that's one of the key points because, you know, as Rael said, you still have to have a reasonable amount of money to be able to use the product effectively. But there are just certain tools that are just not applicable to a retail investor. And you have to approach things in a very different way than you would do an underlying institutional investor. And then at the end of the month, what we do is we do a video conference call. And basically, Rael and I, with an adjudicator, sit there and we discuss our views. And we may discuss new views. We may go over where we differ. For example, as you know, we differ in the short term over our bond view. But we discuss that with our clients and we explain to them why we differ in our bond view. And so that was really part of the process. And those are sort of four deliverables you get once, you know, every month.
I think I love the concept of it because what you're really saying is that you take the institutional grade content that you deliver to your institutional clients and you strip out of it the content that would be of no use to a retail investor. You know, if you guys decide you've got a brilliant call, it's time to short IG9, which is a institutional grade bond index. Great. Unless you've got $100 million under management, you can't short IG9 because you need to do that with an over-the-counter derivative. So you're basically taking the stuff that could be of use to a retail trader out of the institutional quality product and delivering that at a retail price, perhaps a high retail price, but you get what you pay for. I do want to ask a question about that, though, because if you're paying the $40,000 for the institutional product, that gives the institutional client the right to call you up and chat on the phone with you about one of these reports. Is there an opportunity for somebody, you know, what do I get at the $3,000 level? Is there any opportunity to ask questions or to request that you cover certain topics or anything of that nature?
Yeah, you know, there is. And it's particularly for that video. What we're doing is we're encouraging our readers to drop us an email and say, listen, I'd love to ask you a question about this. Or, Rael, you talked about that. Julian, you talked about that. Can you explain what you mean? Or how has your view developed? So, yes, it's really important for us to allow people to come and ask us questions. Now, obviously, because you know it's a high-volume product, we can't have thousands of people on the telephone all the time, or Julian and I would be dead. But this way, we can figure a way that we can group together questions and get people to answer specific questions that answers a whole load of questions that other people have given too. So, yes, we definitely want to get involved with people. And both of us are both available on Twitter. Now, again, we don't give portfolio advice or anything like that. But, you know, we are vocal. We're there. We try and be involved in the conversation and the discussion. We try and add value whenever we can.
There is also a comment section that we have on the Macro Insiders website, and we're hoping that that evolves into something much more sort of fluid. And so it's really up to, you know, the subscribers to sort of post stuff in there, and we certainly are monitoring it. And when we think we can add value, we chirp up on that as well. So there is a sort of relatively, it's embryonic at this stage, but we're hoping it becomes a more active forum of interchange of ideas.
Now, there is no free trial policy for Macro Insiders. Normally, you'd have to pay the full non-refundable $3,000 subscription fee to find out what's really inside. But Real Vision has generously offered our Macro Voices listeners a free copy of a research report, which is normally only available to paying Macro Insiders subscribers. So that provides you with a way to get a taste of what the Macro Insiders content is like without having to sign up. Registered users will find a link to that download. You will have to register your email address with Real Vision because they're strictly limiting this and want to keep track of who it goes out to. But you can find that link in your Research Roundup email. Julian, Raul, I want to thank you so much for another fantastic interview. We have gone over time, but I wanted to let it go over time because you're two of our most popular guests ever. I'm going to have to leave it there now, though. Patrick Ceresna and I will be back as Macro Voices continues right here at macrovoices.com.
Macro Voices is a listener-driven program. Please email requests for specific future interview guests to requests@macrovoices.com. You can email questions for the program to mailbag@macrovoices.com. And we'll answer them on the air from time to time in our mailbag segment. We also welcome your suggestions for how we can improve the program. Now, back to your hosts, Eric Townsend and Patrick Ceresna.
Eric, what a great tag team interview with Raul and Julian. Now, while their comments on bonds and commodities were incredibly insightful, to me, in my mind, the single biggest macro question remains to be answered is the direction of that U.S. dollar. Now, for our newer listeners that don't fully understand the significance, there are macro traders out there that model almost all performance of all asset classes based on these currency trends. Now, so it's so important for us to grasp the primary trend of that dollar index. What was your take on the interview?
I couldn't agree more with what you just said, Patrick, and I think the dollar is the thing that really has my attention this week as a result of listening to this interview, as well as also having a chance to follow up with Juliet DeClercq. After this interview, what I did is I asked Juliet to listen to a preview version of it and to give us her reactions to the comments that Raul and Julian had about the views that she expressed in those two letters to her subscribers, which, again, you can find in your Research Roundup emails. And it's kind of funny. This is so classically Juliet. I sent her an email on Thursday afternoon saying, hey, can you give us some reaction? And she writes back and she says, I'm in a restaurant and don't have time to give you anything of substance, but here's a couple of notes. And then she goes on for 2.5 pages with more detail than Raul and Julian combined. So I'm going to try to very quickly summarize the major points that she made here. I can't even find room for all of it. She says she thinks the U.S. is nearing the end of its business cycle. Maybe there's a last hurrah with tax cuts, but sooner or later, there's going to be more inflation, Fed's going to tighten, curve's going to flatten, U.S. recession is going to be brought about. She thinks, ironically, that U.S. recession will probably arrive sooner than it would have without the tax cuts, just because of the interplay between the things that are going on. The tax cuts actually accelerate the process. This means, she says, that the monetary and macro divergence between the United States and other developed markets will be replaced with convergence. The tax cut is only going to be a hiccup in the cycle. In effect, markets are prolonging the global cycle by weakening the U.S. dollar, the same way the euro was weaker from 2013. This temporarily offsets lower global liquidity as existing liquidity gets revalued against a lower U.S. dollar. This process, Juliet expects, to continue until Europe eventually rolls over as well. She estimates about 18 months lag between cycles. By then, it's unlikely, she thinks, that the ECB will have gotten off the interest rate floor. That means that monetary conditions are going to tighten solely through a strengthening euro, hence her view about the euro strengthening against the U.S. dollar. The only ECB ammo that she predicts they'll have available to loosen with will be asking the Fed to help them by loosening. Juliet believes that these processes are eventually going to take the euro to 130 against the dollar and the yen below 100. At that point, Juliet agrees that the dollar correction starts to bite into Europe and probably Japan. So she anticipates that the play there is not going to be a long dollar. It's not going to be a resumption of the U.S. dollar bull trend, but it's going to be to play the euro and the Japanese yen against the commodity currencies. Juliet is confident that we've seen the cycle low in the euro already. She's looking for an entry right now to get short the dollar against the yen. In summary, she says that the idea of a bullish secular U.S. dollar view doesn't resonate for her. What she's saying is the dollar index is a basket of currency pairs, and that includes the dollar against developed markets, where you have one picture in terms of current account surplus or deficit, and then you've got another set of relationships between the dollar and the commodity currencies. What Juliet is saying is, talk to me about specific pairs. Are we talking dollar against developed markets? Are we talking dollar against emerging markets, commodity currencies? Give me specific pairs and I'll give you an outlook. But she says it's not logical to her to just say the dollar. You've got to think about the dollar versus what. You know, Patrick, we got to get her on the show because she's got so many views. She goes on here. We don't have time in this segment even to summarize her reactions to what Raul and Julian said. So let's try to set her up in the fall lineup that I know you're working on.
Oh, absolutely. I'll definitely reach out to her and get her onto our roster. You know, Eric, what I find interesting about that is the contrasting view of, let's say, looking at individual currency pairs that way and looking at the landscape of the global economy country by country versus contrasting that to the view of someone like Jeffrey Snyder, who looks at the euro dollar markets and looks at this as a structural U.S. dollar global shortage. And his views is that this is actually a big U.S. dollar shortage problem and not an individual country by country story. What's your take on that?
Oh, I think that's an excellent point, and it really speaks to the same idea that Juliet was saying, which is, look, if you want to put a trade on, you've got to know what the rationale is for that. If you've got a view about the dollar, if it's a Juliet view, it's going to be a dollar against a specific currency. If you're basing your trade on Jeffrey Snyder's view, on the other hand, then long the dollar index makes perfect sense because it's a basket of currencies around the world, and that resonates with Jeffrey's view, not the same as Juliet's view. And I think that's probably more in line with Raul's view as well. So you really have to put the trade on in terms of what your specific view is. And I think, as Raul said, time horizon comes into this. Juliet is certainly not saying that you want to be long the euro against the dollar for the next 10 years. She's saying that right here, right now, she sees an opportunity. And remember, she is a tactical institutional advisor. She tells traders how to put trades on. She's thinking about a fairly short institutional trade time frame. Raul tends to think in terms of his Real Vision audience about a much longer time frame, so he has a different view.
Well, you know, what I did was I compiled a chart, and so our listeners can find it in the research roundup. And what I did was I was inspired by Raul when he was trying to compare the current pullback in the dollar index to that of prior U.S. dollar bull markets. And so what I did in this chart is I overlaid the U.S. dollar bull market from 1995 to 2001, where the dollar index went from the low 80s all the way up to $120 on the dollar index. And I overlaid the existing U.S. dollar bull market from 2014 to present. And when he referenced in there is talking about the length and the percentage drop of this current dollar index is about the same length as past ones. This is a very interesting crossroad. And I think that's what both Julian and Raul were both referencing, was that we're at this, fulcrum moment of where either this dollar index is going to find a short-term low and resume back in its primary trend, or there's something different happening, and maybe the dollar is not in this bull market. And it's really interesting that we're here. What's your thinking on this chart?
You know, a light bulb went off as you were talking there, Patrick. What occurs to me is we've got several different views because Juliet's views, Julian's views, and Raul's views are really different in terms of what they foresee. They have different time frames and different logical rationale behind them. But then there's a whole other dimension to this that we haven't even gotten into yet, which is if you're going to look at something like wanting to be long the dollar index if you think 92 is a bottom, well, if 92 turns out not to be the bottom, you've got a problem because there's not a whole lot of technical support levels below that. Are you going to use stop orders as a risk control measure, or are you going to use call options instead? I think if we were to make a matrix of the different views here and then the different ways of trading them, that's a whole postgame show by itself. What if we were to maybe allocate next week's postgame to going through all of these dollar views and thinking about different ways that you could actually translate those to trading strategies based on different time horizons and viewpoints?
Well, it sounds like a great idea, Eric.
Well, let's do that, because I know that we've had a couple of shows in a row run overtime for the last few weeks. So we've got a plan, folks. We know what we're doing in next week's postgame. Meanwhile, we need your help this week with promoting the program. Again, as you know, everything that you can do to help us promote this program, keep us in the top 100 by rating us and reviewing us on iTunes, sending your research roundup emails to your friends and colleagues, and most importantly, register your free account at macrovoices.com, because that's what allows us, the more users we have registered, the more able Patrick is to recruit the very best featured interview guests. The benefit to you is that you'll receive our free research roundup email each week, which never contains advertising or marketing. It's just a compendium of links to all the free cool stuff that we could find on the internet, including graphs and charts and something like the content that you got for free from Real Vision this week that's normally only available to their Macro Insider customers who are paying $3,000 a year for it. So there's plenty of benefit to you, and it helps us to make the show better for everybody. Patrick, tell them what's in this week's research roundup.
All right. Well, in this week's email, you're going to find the transcript for today's interview. There's also going to be the link to the chart that Eric and I discussed overlaying that 1990s U.S. dollar bull market over the current one. There's also the link to that free report on the Macro Insiders Meeting of the Minds. And you'll also find that link of Juliette de Klerk's past reports where she made all of her market calls on the dollar. So you'll find this and so much more in this week's research roundup email. So that does it for this week's episode. We appreciate all the feedback and support we get from our listeners and are always looking for suggestions on how we can make the program even better. Now, for those of our listeners that write or blog about the markets and would like to share their content with our listeners, please send us an email at researchroundup@macrovoices.com or tag it with the MVRR hashtag on Twitter, and we will include it in our weekly distributions. Now, if you have not already, follow our main Twitter account at Macro Voices for all the most recent updates and releases. You can also follow Eric on Twitter at Eric S. Townsend. On behalf of Eric Townsend and myself, thank you for listening, and we'll see you all next week.
That concludes this edition of Macro Voices. Be sure to tune in each week to hear feature interviews with the brightest minds in finance and macroeconomics. Macro Voices is made possible by sponsorship from BigPictureTrading.com, the Internet's premier source of online education for traders. Please visit BigPictureTrading.com for more information. Please register your free account at MacroVoices.com. Once registered, you'll receive our free weekly research roundup email containing links to supporting documents from our featured guests and the very best free financial content our volunteer research team could find on the internet each week. You'll also gain access to our free listener discussion forums and research library. And the more registered users we have, the more we'll be able to recruit high-profile feature interview guests for future programs. So please register your free account today at macrovoices.com if you haven't already. You can subscribe to Macro Voices on iTunes to have Macro Voices automatically delivered to your mobile device each week free of charge. You can email questions for the program to mailbag@macrovoices.com. And we'll answer your questions on the air from time to time in our mailbag segment. Macro Voices is presented for informational and entertainment purposes only. The information presented on Macro Voices should not be construed as investment advice. Always consult a licensed investment professional before making investment decisions. The views and opinions expressed on Macro Voices are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect those of the show's hosts or sponsors. Macro Voices, its producers, sponsors, and hosts Eric Townsend and Patrick Ceresna shall not be liable for losses resulting from investment decisions based on information or viewpoints presented on Macro Voices. Macro Voices is made possible by sponsorship from BigPictureTrading.com and by funding from Fourth Turning Capital Management, LLC. For more information, visit MacroVoices.com.